Hello and welcome, everybody. My name is Sherry Sellers, and you're listening to Making the Change Talk. It's a podcast for people who are thinking about or on their journey towards a tobacco-free life. In this episode, we're going to shine a light on the history of big tobacco in the U.S., how they targeted our most vulnerable communities, and we have two remarkable guests here to help open our eyes. Dr. Terry Richardson. She's a retired internal medicine doctor and serves as board vice chair for the Colorado Black Health Initiative. And Coco Villaluz. Coco is a health equity manager with the American Indian Cancer Foundation. For the past 20 years, she has been educating, mobilizing communities, and focusing on the restoration of traditional tobacco and cultural lifeways. I want to thank both of you for joining us today. Thanks so much. Can you hear me?
Yes, thank
okay.
you.
Ladies, I have to say that this topic reads more like a movie script. Sometimes it's honestly hard to believe. And then other times you don't know whether to get angry or to start crying. Dr. Richardson, for those of us who don't know about the history of targeting big tobacco or targeting by big tobacco, where do you start?
I usually start in the 1950s, of course, before I was born. But the tobacco companies actually did a survey to really look at who was liking menthols, so to speak. And they found that 5% of blacks preferred menthol and 2% of whites preferred menthol. And from there, they said, black people sure do like menthol. And thus the targeted marketing began at that point. You can imagine that's just a small difference, and the majority of people were not smoking menthol, but they took that small difference and moved forward to, you know, start the chain of addiction.
They launched board. Talk to us about the billboards, the magazines, the concerts. I mean, this was targeted.
This was very targeted. They said, hey, if you like menthol, they used movie stars, athletes, very popular people to help advertise these products. Billboards were up in black neighborhoods in some of the bigger cities with large black populations. They had 10 times the number of billboards. They also took vans into the community and distributed free samples of menthol tobacco products. My dad even mentioned he didn't smoke in college, but he remembers them stuffing a small six pack under the doors of the students at a historically black college in Atlanta. So they really were very focused and targeted. There was a lot of cultural appropriation. Their messaging and their video, I mean, the not videos, but actually the imagery that they used was really part of the black culture. They kind of had a lot of cultural appropriation and said, hey, you know, at that time during the 60s and 70s, people started having the big afros. They would have ads with beautiful looking people. Everyone was happy, nice couples, having fun. And really they were giving you the illusion that you would be cool. And so they had the cigarettes cool with a K that would make you a cool person if you smoked them.
Dr. So, Richardson, you said they were studying the way you walked, you talked, what made you happy. I'll be honest, it just blows my mind to think about that. And that it is no accident that 90% of African-American smokers are smoking menthol, because that is the type of cigarette that all of these campaigns targeted.
Absolutely right. And it, depending on who you read, is 80 to 90% of blacks smoke menthol. They had advertising in magazines like Jet, Ebony, Essence. And at the beginning, you had these ads on the front cover, inside of the front cover, the back cover, and all the way in between. You had multiple ads in the early days. Over time, the ads diminished, but they still continue to be in prominent places for quite a few years. But it started way back in the 60s when we were having the Black Power movement. and Blacks fighting for their independence. They said, if you want to be independent, smoke menthol. Look at all the beautiful people that are smoking these products. It was quite irritating. And they had no regard for public health. They were just concerned about the profit. They knew that smoking was bad and these were poisonous sticks, but they continued to market in the community and encourage people to smoke.
Well, I'd like to bring in Coco, because Coco, you were part of a project that went through thousands of tobacco documents. And these are internal emails and messaging that was shared within these companies. Can you tell us about that and some of the things that you found?
Absolutely. And referencing, you know, Dr. Richardson, we were expecting to find a lot of that when it came to the American Indian Alaska Native communities. Our search was to see, after going through the tobacco industry document library, how they were specifically targeting American Indian Alaska Native communities. From other projects that we've seen, we had come across this one study that was focused on the LGBTQ population that they called Project Scum, which was focusing on the homelessness and, you know, providing blankets when, you know, you could think about it where they could really change and actually provide housing. And, you know, but they were labeling all of these different products. So when we were going into our research, you know, and what our question would look like, we actually found the opposite when it came to our communities. We found that they really were romanticizing our traditional aspect of tobacco and what it meant for our communities, how it's so sacred and held with the utmost protocol. And so a lot of the things that we found were the uses of our cultural imagery, such as headdresses or the pipe, and those images and are something that is so sacred for our communities that we would, you know, it's to use it for marketing. It's just like beyond me, because these are things that we hold in high regard, that they are bestowed with such honor and come with so many protocols. So to see it on, you know, package of cigarettes or chewing tobacco just like blows our mind. We also seen through some of our studies that the tobacco industry were utilizing different cultural teachings or images of chiefs and warriors for these marketing advertisements. And so it was just like complete opposite. And when we were doing our search, we were looking like the terms American Indian, you know, traditional tobacco, sacred tobacco. We found some documents, and some of those took us actually to the country of India. And so we started to refine our search and really kind of thinking about it. So we typed in some stereotypical terms that we would hear, and I won't repeat them because I'm just like, it just is such a dishonor. Yeah. But that's where we started to find some of the documents. That's where we were seeing even how they were saying, you know, very derogatory terms towards our culture, and seeing some of the imagery. So we've seen this balance where they were talking about the traditional medicine and getting back to the country's origin of the way that American Indians used to utilize it, but we still utilize it. As an indigenous person, I carry tobacco, I make an offering every day, and it's something that we treat with the utmost respect. So to see it being marketed for death and disease, it just, you know, is just, we should all be outraged, right, that this happening in 2023.
Coco, I'd like to interrupt real quickly that I think there's one famous message that has been released from these documents. Am I right, Dr. Richardson? And I'm going to quote it.
Oh, you know what? And I'm looking at it right now.
Then you tell us. You
I
say
I'm going to tell you that, and I won't name the tobacco company, but a tobacco company executive was asked about these products. And he said, we don't smoke the four-letter word. We just sell it. We reserve the right to smoke for the young, the poor, the Black, and stupid.
And how does that make you feel when you read those words?
That made me very angry. And I remember when I hearken back to the days when I first started doing the work, this was one of the first quotes that I saw. And I said, if people knew this, they would be so upset. But most people didn't know about this. This is something that came about, those documents that Coco was mentioning. There's millions of them, apparently. And this was one of the milder ones that they had in there, because there's a lot that talks about, we intentionally targeted and marketed to a community that was marginalized. And, you know, I focus a lot on the Black community, but they did in the LGBTQ, young people. They have other documents that talk about the fact that they were focus in on the young community. If we get them started early, they can smoke for years. We get them addicted, they smoke for years, and our profit margins continue to go up. But a lot of people have not had the opportunity to read these documents or hear about this. But when you share with people, this is what they did. And this is on the backdrop of Blacks being, it really involved enslaved Africans in the U.S. Serving as a backbone for early tobacco economy. And then here you move to, now we're going to get you to smoke these menthol products that we know are going to lead to your demise. We know that Blacks have high rates of lung cancer and other types of cancer, as well as heart disease and other things that can be associated with smoking. Mm-hmm. It makes you angry.
Yeah.
They knew what they were doing. It wasn't by mistake. It'd be one thing if they didn't know, but they clearly showed in these tobacco documents that they knew what they were doing. And it was all very intentional. It was just pure greed, money over people. It was terrible.
Coco, you said sometimes when you were going through those documents that you had to, I think the words you used with me were, you had to take a break. Talk to us about, put us in that moment when you'd be like, I just can't.
Absolutely. You know, just seeing the derogatory and the stereotypical way that they were portraying us and really dehumanizing us as a nation, and thinking about all of the historical impacts, when you think about the mascots, when you think about the imagery and how harmful that is to us as a people in our community, when that was part of just like the overall historical trauma that, you know, has been impacted by our communities, that we were forcibly removed from our identity. And it wasn't until 1978, when the American Indian Religious Freedom Act passed, that we were allowed to practice our spirituality out in the open. So to see the tobacco industry, you know, by design, crafting these types of strategies and legally crafting these types of strategies to, you know, sell these, I know Dr. Richardson, like the poison sticks, the cancer sticks that are harming our community, and to talk about us in that way, it is very frustrating. And I think my biggest mission was, like, when I was reading through these, I was like, okay, let's take a breath, let's take a pause and remember why we're here and get grounded in our mission and goal was to be able to tell people about the sacred use of tobacco, to be able to tell people, you know, what it means, and getting back to the original intention. And so we really utilize this tagline of keep tobacco sacred. And that was always our, you know, foundation and core, and taking a break and getting back to that, because you can go to the documents, and actually at one point there was a tobacco repository that housed a lot of these documents. And I swear these rows were like a mile long of just boxes and boxes of tobacco industry documents that were sharing a lot of their marketing strategies. And every year they pump millions of dollars within to the states. And, you know, it's over, I think, $1 billion in marketing across the country. And then when you think about that on a global impact and how they're using, you know, the labor for not good things. So I think that's always been my message. And if you hear me speak, I always go, how do we get back to keeping tobacco sacred? How can we as allies, even if you're not using it in a traditional way, how do we get on that same page of honoring the people who do? And that's where we can begin the healing. That's where we can stop, you know, the harm of commercial tobacco use. And I know with the evolving landscape, with the tobacco industry and the vaping and the e-cigarette, mm-hmm. like, you know, we got to get crafty again in our messaging, and you know, kind of how do we beat them at their own game?
Right, because we think, okay, this is history. But as a mom of two boys, I feel like I'm seeing history repeat itself now, and that the new target are the teens. It's the teens, and it's vaping. Do you feel that way too, that you're seeing some of the same things, some of the same tactics being used again?
I would say yes. I mean, it's always been about the young people, because you need people that become addicted and can smoke for years to make your money. And not only did the tobacco companies market to try to get the young people to smoke and using these flavors, they actually engineered the cigarettes. They determined how much menthol was needed, but they also made sure to give money for things that were important to the communities, like the Cool with a K Jazz Festival and other musical events. They paid some of the historically Black organizations that did not have money. I mean, you think about the history of Blacks in America. First, we were enslaved, and then we were suppressed. And so they were some of the first companies to give executives jobs. So they really did their homework. They had all sorts of sciences really working on this commercial tobacco product, and they looked at what was going on in the U.S. How could we manipulate a group of people to make them feel like we're really trying to help you? There was even a recent article about how the African American History Museum in Washington, D.C. had accepted tobacco money. And there was a big debate over whether that was good or bad. But this is not a new tactic that they've used. In the past, as they used our actors, our famous people. They would pay money to even some of our social justice organizations like NAACP. Some of those people have turned and they are not getting the money, but back in the day, they were paying money and giving money to all these organizations and to some of our leaders. It wasn't just organizations, it was some of our leaders. And, you know, the beat goes on.
So Coco, why is it important? Because sadly, so few of us know about this history. Why is it important that we share this information? What is the call to action?
I think the call to action is really focusing on our communities thriving, right? We want our relatives to be thriving. And really that what that looks like to us is stopping the commercial tobacco industry, educating on what the tobacco industry is doing and targeting our communities. And, you know, we understand the complexities. We understand that there are lack of resources. And so the tobacco industry is really preying on vulnerable organizations. And even though some, you know, may have thousands of dollars, they're still utilizing and trying to leverage that to be able to, you know, create those partnerships. And that's something that we've always talked about within our communities too, is like, we definitely want to stop taking tobacco industry dollars, but how do we support that when we're trying to do good in our community? So it's a very complex issue. And our whole mission has been not to, you know, shame or blame anybody, because people are doing what they need to do. And so for us, like, it's like, what can we do as a community, as funders, as organizations, as we're doing this work to combat health? Because we know there are so many competing priorities, right? We know that there's lack of housing, you know, the food resources in a community where I live, you know, there's food deserts. And so it's just like we're constantly trying to survive. And so when you're thinking about these tobacco industry and what we can do, getting back to our why, we really want people to live. We want them to be healthy. We don't want to be number one in death and disease rates of, you know, all these cancer related issues. We don't want to see our communities having the highest menthol use rate. We want to see us, you know, on that flip. And so it takes all of us. It takes a lot of education. And again, I'm like, I'm going to sound like that broken record and getting back to like the why of what tobacco is. And so we're asking people, especially with the American Indian Cancer Foundation, to honor the restoration and reclamation of these traditional life ways. And we feel like that will be able to heal a lot of the work that we're doing in this interconnectedness. Earlier, Dr. Richardson talked about her journey before we joined, and that's part of the circle I think about with tobacco. Once you're in it, you're not going to leave, even though you may go. Right. But I think like that's the power of what the medicine is, because it is a sacred medicine.
Dr. Richardson, we are almost out of time. What is the one message you want to get across to people listening today, many of whom are on their quit journey? They're in the middle of this right now. What do you want them to know, especially when it comes to targeting? How should they be using that information?
You know, and that's kind of a difficult question. I think a lot of people just aren't aware of this social justice issue that the tobacco companies really targeted and marketed to our community. But we are working hard to make sure that those who have started smoking menthol have a way to support quitting. One of those methods is trying to ban the product for sure. But in the meantime, that there are great resources out there to help people quit. We try to refer people to the quit line. We've actually looked at some of the cessation resources out there. And getting out and walking, getting some fresh air, finding ways to deal with your stress, that's going to help even if you're smoking. The stress just makes it difficult. So we are here as an organization, the Colorado Black Health Collaborative, to help people in their quit journey, and also there to help educate people and make them aware of this critical issue in our community.
Coco, one last thought from you. What would you like people to know? Encourage them. We say that there's all this history, but it's not, it doesn't mean that you are destined to smoke.
Absolutely. I think about where you are now. Think about the kind of ancestor and the legacy that you want to be. And that is living in a good and healthy way, free from commercial tobacco. And so just encouraging you, I love when you're talking about walking and running and getting out and just going back into Mother Earth and reclaiming that and you know who you are as an individual and thinking about the generations to come.
Well put. Coco and Dr. Richardson, my sincere thanks for being here and sharing this historical trauma. One of you used those words and I stole them from you, but sharing that with us. And to those of you who are listening in, thank you. Be sure to listen to our next conversation on Making the Change Talk. And please remember, the Quit Line is here for you 24/7. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or click on the Enroll Now link on the podcast homepage. Thank you so much.